All right. So we'll welcome everybody. I think this panel labeled, are the capital markets open today? This is the panel where we're going to drill down a little bit and maybe even rebut some of the stuff that our prior speaker said. But what we'll try to do is try to parse through what's out there and try to give at least our panel's views of what we see is happening and what hopefully will happen. Before we jump into the questions, I think it's maybe a good idea for our panel to introduce themselves and maybe give maybe a minute or two about what they do in their institution. Wiley, why don't you start and work your way down because Sandy's is on his way.
Thanks. Wiley Griffiths, I run our maritime practice at Morgan Stanley on the investment banking side, so our primary activities are capital raising, both equity, debt, hybrid products, and also advisory. Mostly it's been equity, and we'll talk a little bit about that during the session, and some of it's been equity that I didn't think anybody could raise recently, so it's been kind of interesting times over the last 3 to 6 months, and we'll get into that. But it's across all shipping sectors and full service. So, Philippe?
Well, I guess more of the same for Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I'm a managing director heading the maritime investment banking effort in London. Obviously work closely with my colleagues in New York to provide capital market solutions, whether that's debt capital markets or equity capital markets, or M&A advisory, which, again, maybe a newer theme in shipping and maritime services.
My name's Eric Schless, and I do what these gentlemen do. I run our transportation and logistics group. I'm at Wells Fargo Securities. I'm not concerned just with shipping, but shipping is a large part of what we do, and we provide the same sort of services sometimes in competition with and sometimes in conjunction with some of the other people on this desk. So we're very pleased to be here, and we've been very fortunate to work with several very good companies, many of whom are in the audience. Thanks for having us.
Andy, please.
Sorry for being late. I'm Sandy Redden from Knight Capital Markets and the managing director in charge of the shipping practice. So unlike these three gentlemen, I'm not corporate finance or investment banking. I'm a relationship manager, and I cover Greece and the shipping industry.
Thank you, Sandy. My name is Tony Backos. I am a corporate partner with the law firm of Watson, Farley & Williams, based in New York, but spent some time here in Greece as well. And I practice securities and M&A, and Watson Farley has offices in all the major shipping capitals in the world, and we are actively involved in capital markets. But let me now dive into sort of the questions, and let's start by with a direct question, and let's just ask if capital markets are open today, yes or no, and in a brief, maybe 30 seconds or so or a minute, if they are, what kind of deals do you see in the equity capital markets? Let's start with equity first. Wiley,
I'll start. We've seen a fair amount of the equity markets recently. We across sectors. So, most notably, probably the easiest sector to issue equity in is LNG. It's got good return characteristics in the segment. Surprisingly to me, we were able to raise dry bulk capital last week for Genco, and that was one where I would categorize it as pretty opportunistic. That's a stock that was trading 500,000 shares or less every day in January, and then all of a sudden started trading 2.5 million shares. And so I think there's an opportunity in the capital markets for investors who may be new to shipping, but looking for ways to play global economic recovery, but it's very window-driven. I think the same is true of tankers. We've done some deals both on the product side for Scorpio Tankers and NAT and TNK in January and February, and it was, again, opportunistic. When the volume comes up, obviously investors are making a play. They may be doing that in concert with other investments, but we've managed to raise some equity, albeit smaller than it was in better markets, but we've seen LNG product, crude tanker, and dry bulk all in the last 60 days. So I think the capital markets are open for existing public companies. I think with LNG, there's a market for new companies to become public. but I think the other sectors and IPOs related to those segments is going to take a little while until their fundamentals improve.
Thanks. Philippe?
I guess I'll echo what Wally was saying. I think the reality is that the threshold for someone to tap the capital markets is just higher. And by that, it's, you know, or rather the focus on the security valves is more intense. And so investors will focus on the fundamentals of the underlying sector, but also on the use of proceeds and also on the potential of getting some form of return, whether that's in the form of a dividend or usually in the form of dividends. I think that these are things that investors focus on these days. And there are not a lot of sectors that have the capacity and a lot of companies that have the capacity to be able to justify or to offer the markets what they're looking for. So I think we'll continue seeing some sporadic activity, and as Wally said, in particular for companies that have a track record and a good use of proceeds and are able to offer investors a good return, but it will continue being challenging, in particular if the underlying fundamentals of the sector are tough.
Eric?
I think that's all been well said. I would add that it really, to me, is symptomatic of the early stage of a recovery, early recovery in the cycle, and so that deals are smaller. It's most definitely a buyer's market, and so that discounts for existing public companies doing deals are wider than we've experienced at other points in the cycle. But there's no doubt that there is interest there, and I think that as you see a little more faith in global economic recovery, I think that you're going to see the size of deals get bigger. I think you're going to see discounts roll back. And I think this sort of opportunistic window phenomenon that Wiley described will give way to a more systematic and methodical ability to access the markets.
Sandy?
I would say Eric just coined it pretty well. I mean, what it comes down to is capital markets are open, but they're very selective, looking for solid management and good cash flow. So a number of years ago, we saw lots of smaller companies come public. That market's not there today. There is a capital markets for the right company.
What do we mean when you say, when we're talking about opportunistic, what does that mean? What does that translate to the folks in the audience? Does it mean that, you know, just the trading of the value of the shares based on some other metric is there's value there? What do you mean by opportunistic? What's the driver behind that? Or Wiley, you started it. What's the?
Sure, I got us onto the topic. I would describe it as a condition where, in this case, existing public companies can tap the markets. And what I was referring to, for example, in the Genco transaction was trading volume. There were obviously, you know, 2.5 million shares worth of buyers every day grinding that stock price higher, which allowed them to access the markets. And as opposed to in what I would call normal return or normal markets for dry bulk, for example, where you've got cash flow and you've got yield and you've got NAVs where you can make some corporate finance judgments on valuation, this is really an opportunity where investors are making a speculative bet on where dry bulk goes from here. And so it's less to do with what's the price to NAV multiple, or does that company, have they just signed up great new charters? It's more about where does dry bulk go from here relative to consensus?
Oh, that's helpful. It sort of dovetails what Eric says about sort of the big macro picture and sort of riding it along. Let's talk a little bit about debt. Debt capital markets. We got anything, Sandy? Why don't you start this way? I'm going to pick on you now.
The answer is yes, but I'm going to go back to debt. The debt capital markets are wide open, but issuers in the shipping community might not want to access them simply because it's cash flow and the investor is looking for yield, right? So what works for MLPs on the equity side doesn't necessarily work for the yield in a high yield situation. There is a demand. There's a lot of money on the sidelines looking to come into the market. We have pitched deals from $150 to $500,000 that largely don't work when you look at the model for the ship owner or the company. You can't take away all their cash flow to service the debt.
Eric, Philippe, we'd go down the road.
Sure. Thanks, Tony. I think that the debt capital markets, particularly the high-yield markets, are very, very attractive right now. They are at historically strong they're at a point of historic strength. Transactions are getting priced at levels that people really have not seen in a long time. There is a pretty broad range of coupons within the shipping sector, and it's a fairly limited universe of issuers out there. So that I think that it is not a mature market. Shipping is not mature in the high yield market, but there is a lot of appetite, and I think that if people can get through the rating agency issues and all that sort of thing, that it's a form of, I will call it, semi-permanent capital that is really very, very interesting. So I would encourage people to think about it.
What kind of issuer? What's the typical sort of? What are the typical pick? What's the typical picture of an issuer that would be most sort of open to high yield debt?
Well, I think it's obviously there are size parameters, so you can issue at $150 million. At $200 million is when you really overcome any liquidity premiums that you would otherwise pay. So that there has to be, in and of itself, there has to be sufficient size to warrant that. And I think, obviously, a track record, a management team, all the things that we look for, you know, as we take a company into public markets, be they equity or debt. But I think that it's really being able to show that some predictability of cash flow to satisfy the rating agencies.
I think I'm a little bit more cautious. Not necessarily, I like what Eric was saying around the high yield market, but I think in terms of shipping companies tapping the high yield market, I think that becomes a little bit more difficult in the current environment, just because a high yield investor is all about, you know, downside protection. So that's their number one priority. It's not about the upside of an equity investor. And so when you're looking at, you know, renegotiation of contracts, which have been, you know, in some cases quite visible over the last few months, when you're looking at, you know, Chapter 11s in the shipping sector, which have happened in the last few months, those tend to scare high-yield investors off a little bit around, you know, when it comes to shipping. Now, I'm generalizing shipping. There are some pockets of shipping where the fundamentals are strong. There are some pockets of shipping companies, even within challenging segments, that have very attractive cash flow with very good counterparties. So I'm not saying the high yield market is not there. I think it has become considerably more expensive than it was when, you know, a year or 2 years ago, when a few shipping companies were tapping or have done it successfully and repeatedly in some cases. But I think spreads have widened considerably because of the reasons I mentioned earlier. So I think it's a market that's going to be more selective, at least in the near term.
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. I would say, you know, it's a great time for, you know, base rates. They're very low. I think the high yield market in broadly is in great shape. In shipping, I think people have learned some tough lessons. You know, we can go through the case studies, but I think most of us know them, where some bondholders are feeling pain, and so it just makes it a little more pricey for new issuers. I think, you know, one key is, or question is, you know, where is debt going to come from in a shrunken bank market? And I think the answer is it's going to come from businesses, from other types of debt, and it's probably going to be supported by cash flow, not asset values. And so if you have good charters, like we're seeing and have seen in the last kind of 9 months in LNG, for example, then you can, yeah, securitize is a big word and sometimes a bad word in the capital markets, but you can use those cash flows as collateral to create solutions for a smaller bank market. So my view is that will be the next phase, is using charters with good counterparties to replace bank debt.
Thank you, Wiley. I'm going to turn to something that maybe a lot of folks here are thinking about, and we're going to turn to IPOs. But my question on IPOs or initial public offerings are actually, it's twofold. One is whether they're possible today. That's a basic question of whether they exist. And the second question is whether the recent SEC rule change, and Sean Frost mentioned this earlier today, and let me just repeat it for the people who didn't hear it this morning. The SEC amended their rules several months ago. No longer is it possible for foreign private issuers, essentially private companies, which many of the Greek shipping companies were, to file confidentially, on a confidential basis, with the SEC. What that means is that many issuers that benefited in the past of talking to their lawyers, their accountants, their lining up their underwriters, and having everything sort of set and go through the SEC review process for months on end, possibly sometimes, clearing the comment period, that no longer is possible on a confidential basis. So what's happening now is you'll find a little bit more circumstances like Gaslog, for example, where typically Gaslog only months ago would have been able to do this whole review process confidentially and not be open to scrutiny or to criticisms or to analysis and whatnot. So my second part of my question is do you guys think that the rule change, where now issuers are going to, from the get-go, from the beginning, have to file confidentially, do you think it's going to have a chilling effect on what these folks are considering? So IPO is possible, if yes or no, and then do you think there's going to be a chilling effect? Let me start with Philippe, and then we'll bounce around.
I think around whether IPOs are feasible or not, I think we've partly answered that question, which is it depends what segment of shipping you're talking about, and it depends on the fundamentals of the company's cash flows. But I think generally speaking, LNG, for example, where the fundamentals are strong, clearly there's a scarcity value of LNG out there. So that's obviously a sector that's attractive or would be attractive to investors. Or if you're able to sustain an attractive dividend and build a strong cash flow story, again, there's potentially a place for those type of IPOs in the market today. I think, generally speaking, investors are probably not willing to take risk in certain other segments of the shipping market and to guess where, you know, the bottom is, in particular when it comes to a new company trying to tap the markets. So I guess the answer is, as any good banker, you never say yes or no. You say a bit of yes and a bit of no. In terms of your second question, I don't think that's going to have any material impact in terms of the confidentiality or foreign private issuers' benefits. I think the reality is that it was an additional option value of deciding when to go public. But whether that happens a few months earlier, I don't think that's necessarily going to change or should deter anyone tapping the U.S. markets. I think, on the contrary, the reality is that, you know, the decision or the go-no-go was really taken at that point in anyhow. But if, you know, when it was private or when it was confidential, rather, it gave you another point in time where you can decide to pull without having made any public announcements.
Eric, thank you, Philippe. Eric?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say the window is barely open. It is for in certain very selective cases, and I think that a strong market overcomes the concerns about early disclosure of your company's business and its financial results. So, I think that we happen to be at a point right now where the IPO market generally is difficult. It's more difficult for shipping than it is for the overall market, and so that just accentuates any concerns about early tipping of the hand.
Sandy?
Well, I think Philippe and Eric just put it pretty clearly. I mean, the market is open, but it's very, very selective, and that's period. Whether this regulation change makes a big difference, everybody sitting at this table has got their name on an IPO. We've all been waiting a year or two because these are confidential filings. So what it might do, in fact, I think it makes very little difference other than the fact that for the four of us, it might make it more competitive because now you have a gas log. You can call them and say, here I am, book runner, whatever it might be. But I think maybe it equals the playing field a little bit.
All right. Well,
Yeah, I think the IPO market is open, as Philippe said, for companies that have existing good fundamentals. I don't think it's open for speculative capital or folks trying to pick the bottom. And I think the new rules are interesting, but I think it's more interesting for us in this room who follow shipping and like to talk about the new deals and what's going on, and less important for, I think, for what how the deal actually goes. I think investors focus on the company when it's finally packaged and ready for market, and that's when they really kind of sharpen their pencils. But I definitely agree with the point that you do. The confidential filing did give you a little longer to withdraw if that was the course of action, but I don't think it's going to have a material impact.
Practically, I thought the confidential process also allowed you to sort of get your filing in, get the clock started, and yeah, you could maybe change the acquisition, the identified fleet. You'd be a little bit more, how should we say, creative as the process went along, and then you sort of began to really, really sharpen the pencils.
Yeah, but I think I totally agree. I think what would happen is, say, for example, they didn't have the identified fleet, we would all look at it and read about it, but the investors would focus on the red herring prospectus once the fleet was in there. So
right. Thank you, guys. Let's go even more granular, talking about valuation of public companies, that kind of thing. Dividends still for the existing public companies. What are we talking about? What are investors looking for? Is it back just to being opportunistic again? This is for, I guess, sort of maintaining the valuations of companies and whatnot going forward. I mean, what are investors looking for?
I'll start it off quickly. I think dividends are always helpful, but I think the key is, are they sustainable? I think investors have come accustomed to dividends coming down or being reduced in the world of shipping and other cyclical industries, and so I think the key is putting forth a credible dividend number, and if you can, the higher it is, the more it should reflect the strong fundamentals of the business. But I don't think you should put one in if it can't be sustained, because you can quickly end up in that kind of small cap orphan category of companies.
I think investors want to be able to, you know, get their returns either through a growth story or through a dividend or a sustainable dividend payment. I think that's an incredibly important point. I think in terms of the, you know, the upside or the growth, exactly, that's where, you know, LNG, for example, has been one of the reasons why it's been attractive. I think in other segments where the fundamentals are not as strong, then it's all about a sustainable dividend. Now, it can be about a sustainable dividend in LNG as well, but I think those are the two priorities. It's growth potential or dividend attractive, a sustainable dividend payment going forward. Obviously, all of that within an attractive valuation package.
I think there are examples of companies that have eliminated their dividend and their stock has done fine. And I think that's perhaps a bit of a variation on the sustainability theme, but I think that it really gets back to the credibility of management. And in a very cyclical industry, when you're at the low end of the cycle, I think the most important thing is for management to have a vision, have a conviction about that vision, and to have a lot of credibility. And so that there's a real fundamental in saying that in a capitally intense business where we're in a down cycle is the best thing to be doing, to giving money out when our share price is depressed. And I think there are a few very notable examples of companies that have said no, that's not the right thing to do. And in fact, their stocks have done just fine. So I think it's really more about management credibility than anything else.
I'd add to that, while that's true, there's companies that have canceled their dividend. I think communicating with the public is key. So if you're to change your dividend policy and you don't want to be orphaned, you need to communicate. There are a number of companies out there that are growth stories. Scorpio is a great example, that don't pay dividends. But they communicate well with the public. People are betting on the growth. There's companies like the Navios that are paying dividends. If they were to change that, they have a long history of being very clear and not opaque. They're clear when they communicate. So I think that's key.
Right. Let me change a little bit the topic and go back to sort of what our prior speaker was saying, and in comparison also to sort of the Far East, because I think the rumor had it that, you know, there were some folks in Greece and in other jurisdictions looking to list in Hong Kong their shipping companies. And, you know, well, I guess what I would like a response to is if a client came, their prospective client came to you guys and said, hey, I'm really looking to list in Hong Kong or even in Oslo. Well, what's the advantage to them to go there as opposed to the United States? And we'll basically say, hey, no, U.S. is better, and here's the reason why. Wiley, back to you.
Back to the theme of opportunistic windows. I think there are times when it's – I think the short answer is the U.S. market is the deepest pool of capital, and that's typically where most of the comparable companies are. So that's my base answer, not just because I work in New York. The Oslo and Hong Kong have had periods where in Oslo, offshore companies have been quick listed. There's a slightly lower regulatory or at least documentation bar in Oslo and in Hong Kong. So you can get listed quick and you can take advantage of those windows even as a new public company. And I think, you know, early last year and towards the last half of 2010, we saw some real strength in the Hong Kong market where investors were looking at maritime assets and less so in the micro way that I think we traditionally have looked at it in the U.S., where it's NAV and it's one type of vessel or shipping class, and they were looking at things a little more broadly. We heard concepts such as companies being valued on book value, not steel value, and I think as the dust settled, there have been few precedents where you could look back and say, "Gee, I was glad that market was open. It was a heck of a lot better than the U.S." I think my view is it reverts back to, what are the and these guys have said it a few times before. What is the management like, and what is your business like? What do the returns look like? And I think investors, whether they're wherever they reside, are going to cut through to that.
Thank you, Wally. Eric, I'll hop for loop.
Okay. I think that in conjunction with being the most liquid market, it also has the most sophisticated group of research analysts in the United States. And that's something that I think really one begets the other, obviously. But I think that there are times, as Wiley said, where other markets have appeared more attractive. I think that there's just a critical mass in the United States of investors, analysts, and capital that really it's a bit of a virtuous circle. So I think that if you look over periods of time, the best valuations and the clearest analysis has come out of the U.S. markets.
Sandy?
So I agree with both my partners up here. I would say Knight doesn't really care because we trade on 100 destinations worldwide, and we're going to trade the majority of your stock if you're a shipping public company anyway. But one thing that's pointed out is there is a deep pool of capital in the U.S., and there's the perceived value to the U.S. markets. The portfolio managers don't particularly care if you're in different industries, whether you trade in Australia or Toronto or Frankfurt or London. Portfolio manager is largely going to do his own research. In the shipping industry, however, these PMs are looking at everyone else's research to form consensus to make sure they're not missing something. And the research in the shipping industry is really based in the U.S. There's only one larger public company in London. There's a scattering in Singapore and Hong Kong. But the shipping market research is based in the U.S. So for the bigger portfolio managers, they're going to look to form consensus with the research that's
now, could that be a reason why sort of valuations are greater in the United States, or is that just a myth?
There's, London, you might be orphaned and have an illiquidity discount. In the U.S., if you're doing your job in communicating, you have a wide, diverse audience of retail and institutional. I don't know personally a lot about the Asian markets other than we make markets there. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you can suffer an illiquidity discount.
I think it's generally very difficult to meaningfully compare valuations across markets because, every company is very different or even within a dry bulk sector, you know, whether the capital structure, the charter profile, the dividend payment, all of these are factors that will affect the valuation one way or another. So I think it's very difficult to pull conclusions on the valuation. I will, however, even though based in London, echo everything that everyone else has said, that the U.S., generally speaking, has a depth, you know, the retail, for example, element, which is huge, but generally has a depth, the research knowledge to continue being the market of choice for shipping. I think the only exception, and that's where we've seen Asia playing a role, is when you see national champions or regional powerhouses, that's where the local markets or the Asian markets, or for that matter, the Nordic markets, are very receptive. You know, an AP Moller Maersk being listed in Denmark because it's a national champion, NOL in Singapore, you know, the Japanese ones in Tokyo. So the U.S. is not the only market, but it's probably the one with the breadth and depth that very few others have. But if you have a very strong regional story, I'm sure other markets would be receptive as well.
Philippe, that's a good point. I think, just speaking from a Watson Farley perspective, I mean, we've opened up an office in Hong Kong as well with capital markets capability, for the very reason that you say, that there are these regional players that are known to the region, and they're going to take advantage of their local markets because they're most well known there. They have the brand name, and we're going to sort of support them as they seek to list as well in London and in other jurisdictions, and I think that's an important, I think, movement forward that at least we're seeing. Let me now ask a little bit something. Hopefully, it's hopeful and looks forward. What things need to change in order to sort of get things, you know, up and going in the capital markets? We say they're open, but I guess what are some of the metrics we need to see happen before we see a broader appetite for equity capital markets, let's say? Eric, you want to start off?
I think it's pretty simple. I mean, you cut the order book and grow the world economy, and we'll be back in business.
So charter rates can just remain low?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just... obviously it's an industry that's economically sensitive, and I think that it's also an industry which is acutely subject to supply and demand, and both of those happen to be working against it in many sectors right now. So, you know, as those things correct themselves, I think you'll see a return to a more normalized reception for this kind of, and it really will be, frankly, it's as the green shoots start to show themselves that you will see that return. But I think those are, you know, two broad elements that if we could fix that, we'd be talking about a lot of different things today.
Philippe and then Wiley?
I think it's sentiment change, and that encompasses a lot of what Eric was saying. So sentiment change towards shipping, and secondly, and that's a consequence of the first point, which is you need to see the existing shares and the existing deals performing well. The companies that are already listed or transactions that have happened, whether that's an IPO or an add-on, they need to be able to perform, and investors to make money in shipping, and that's going to reignite the momentum behind that industry.
Yeah, I would agree with all that, and I think investors typically like to have the worst behind them and it to be more or less proven out, and so typically they're a little late to the game, at least in the public markets. So I think that change in sentiment and seeing that tanker or dry bulk rates haven't been below cash flow break-even levels for a couple of quarters is probably when people start making bigger steps into the market.
Sandy?
I would only add that there is a market right now. It's more on the private equity side, which I've been around a long time, and I haven't seen this ever. 2 years ago, it would take us 12 or 14 months to get a private equity term sheet for a shipping company. That was dead in the water for the last year. In the last month or so, in the last quarter, we've seen a number of private equity firms be more like a financial investor or a hedge fund coming in and looking at, all right, capital markets window for these public companies, it's not there. The banks are restrictive other than, you know, DVB and a few others. There's opportunities. So they're looking at things skipping along the bottom, and why nobody can predict is that the bottom. It might be close to it, private equity is coming in, and we've done term sheets that have taken 3 weeks. So that's replacing some of the public or some of the bank capital.
Let's continue on the private theme. Guys, Wiley, and then all along the way down, I mean, do you see this is now a time where, you know, private equity is coming in to just sort of fill the gap for these shipping companies, or is it another source?
I think it's another source. I think private equity took a run at shipping, you know, a couple of years ago and realized that there's, you know, governance is difficult. You know, ship owners and private equity or financial sponsors tend to think differently about the world and about investments. But I do think that I agree with Sandy. I'm seeing a lot more reverse inquiry from financial sponsors asking about this asset class and shipping in general. I think they realize now that, you know, they're not going to pick the bottom, but we're probably close to in a couple of sectors. So,
and there's probably knowledge already. I mean, these guys have probably now. There's been a time now.
They've been spending
years
time on
it. They've gotten their hands around it.
Yeah. Yep. And you look at Apollo, who bought raw assets. So it's not just companies; it's assets as well.
Philippe.
I was going to say exactly what you said, which is, you know, what has really changed in the last couple of years is the knowledge base of private equity as a whole towards shipping. I'll tend to agree a little bit with Wiley. I'm not sure how many of them will actually transact in shipping, right? But I think there is definitely a knowledge base that's considerably more important. And so I think we'll see more than what we've seen, but I don't think they're going to – that's the answer to the funding gap. I think the funding gap is just, you know, too big for that to be filled by from private equity. But I think things, you know, dynamics are in their favor. So if you are private equity and you have decided you're comfortable with shipping, it's a good time to be looking around.
Eric?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that's been said and add that with the capital scarcity that exists in shipping, it allows private equity firms to aspire to the type of returns that they need to create for their investors. And I think that that's probably a broad theme, which is it's a buyer's market. And so that it's not overly surprising that you see more expensive forms of capital, whether it's at the lending level or at the equity investing level, coming into the sector.
Great. I have one more question, but I prefer maybe to open up to questions. We've got about a minute and a half. Questions? Please.
Thanks very much. Or very limited windows of opportunity. How important is it to be first from your sector? And particularly with respect to IPOs, thereafter, what influence does that withdrawal of confidentiality from the filings possibly have? So just to give you an example, for example, the Gessler filing has now been out there for a few weeks. And the fact that it's public, what kind of opportunity does that give for another company from the segment to hurry up their filing? And what if any importance does that race to the market have?
I'll comment on the legal, but why don't you guys? I'll just throw it open on the commercial financial. Anybody want to take the answer?
Sure, I'll be quick. I think the biggest issue is, first of all, I think if a sector is doing well, there's not going to be a scarcity of capital. I think the risk is that the first public company doesn't do well, and it kind of sullies the market or investors' views of other companies when they see them coming. I do think there's a finite number of companies per sector. I think, you know, we obviously saw a lot of companies come to market and investors had a tough time differentiating them. But I don't think, you know, for example, Gaslog and others, I think there's going to be ample capital for LNG if those fundamentals, for example, hang together.
Financial.
I'll only say, I mean, I completely agree. The risk is that it underperforms. The reality is if you're the first mover, you're taking a bigger risk. But the return potential is, you know, potentially more significant. So you take a bigger risk because you're stepping in an unknown, but you de-risk an element, which is if you were coming second or third, you have the risk of the performance of the first couple. So,
yeah, and from the legal perspective, I think, let's face it, I think if you're dealing in the sector, you've seen a lot of issuers before. You've gone through their comment process, whether you're the issuer or you've read the public comment letters. But I think what is important for GasLog or any other subsector that sort of goes out will be to see the type of disclosure that's out there. And, for example, I mean, people that have a memory in this industry into the minutiae, there was a time where, you know, there was a big forecast section in the prospectus where you had to sort of forecast your dividends out for a while, and then you went back to a normal issuer, which you would see in other industries, back to the typical prospectus. It all depends on sort of what the underwriters will need to sell the deal, and I think by and large the lawyers will have seen it before and are at least privy to the issues. I think there'll be some issues that will always warrant lawyers to think about the risk factors and other things, but it'll really be a question that first one will be the foil that everyone sort of judges and uses as a model, and then it's a variation on the theme from there. I hope we answered your question. Anybody else? Maybe we can even go. Oh, please, Carly. Purely financial.
It's a great question. It's one that a lot of our clients ask us as they go to their boards. I think health of the company obviously comes first, and one aspect though that we often go to our capital markets partners or question we go to them with is should we keep a very modest dividend to retain our yield or income focused investors if we've historically been a dividend paying company? And I think the answer currently is yes. Make sure that you can obviously afford it and it's not going to compromise the financial well-being of the company. But I think income investors appreciate, a little bit of income, even if it's a reduction from where you were paying in the mid-cycle or better times.
Yeah, I think that I think there's a different question if you're already public and already paying a dividend, because then if you stop paying a dividend, there are investors who either choose to or by charter must invest in dividend-paying stocks, and so that can put a lot of pressure on the price of the stock. So I think it's a different it's a different set of considerations if you are not yet public or if you are already public and paying a dividend.
Great. Well, any last questions? I think we can maybe conclude on behalf of the panel. Thank you for your attention, and thank you, Nick, for a great conference.